Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
Picture this. You are out on a hike in a very remote place. Let's assume you've got the right clothes and shoes on, but you have no cell phone or no service, no compass, and no map. How could you find your way back to civilization, and what might you discover along the way? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest has been trekking since childhood, and he can find his way to safety by simply observing nature, the leaves and branches on trees, the paths frequented by animals, the clover in open fields, even the mud on the ground. Tristan Gooley has led expeditions on 5 continents, climbed mountains in 3, and flown and sailed solo across the Atlantic Ocean. His new book is called The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs. Use outdoor clues to find your way, predict the weather, locate water, track animals, and other forgotten skills. Tristan, and welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
You stress that successful outdoor observation is less about extraordinary skill than about choosing to notice things that other people don't see.
Yes, I think we've all got into a bit of a groove of thinking that these are things that our ancestors could do and that we can't. And actually, they're very simple. And our ancestors weren't more intelligent than us. They just chose to look at these things. If we go back a long time, it's because they had to, otherwise they would die. So we've got this interesting situation now where we can do these things, but we don't have to. I'm never sort of saying we absolutely have to practice these skills. My whole argument, and the reason I've collected all these skills in the book, is it makes life a lot more interesting and a lot more fun.
Well, how does relying on your senses for navigation change the nature of a hike into the wilderness?
Well, I think that the simplest thing is you just notice a lot more. What I say to people when I'm teaching them, because I run courses as well, is I say, you know, don't leave stuff at home. If you would normally take a map and a compass or a GPS or any of these bits of kit, take what you would normally take to be safe and sensible. But before you refer to them, see if you can answer the things you were expecting them to tell you. So if you were going to look at the map to see, is that a river in the distance? Instead of getting the map to give you that answer, just pause and say, well, I'm going to try and work it out. And you look out there and just see how the terrain changes, see how the plants change, see how the animal behavior changes. And it doesn't matter if you're wrong, because you've still got the fallback. It gets you looking, it gets you noticing.
For most of human history, maps didn't even exist, but our ancestors knew enough to take advantage of a hill when they found one.
Absolutely. I mean, if we look at the earliest records of human movement and migration across the planet, we find the vast majority of planet Earth had been explored by human beings thousands of years before any of the technology that we now take for granted. Granted, quite a few of them died along the way, but you know, enough people got to these remote islands in the Pacific and crossed the great land masses. So it is doable.
You know, Tristan, I learned a lot reading the book. There were some things that you pointed out that I thought, oh, I've known that, but I've never really known it. And one of those is the fact that distant features on the landscape appear lighter in color than things that are closer.
Yeah, that's a lovely example of something that's not it's not a must-have practical tool. It's not, for example, like finding the North Star is hugely practical and more accurate than a compass. That's the example of a lot of the things I put in the book to get people looking, because it's so easy. And as you say, you've noticed it, but maybe not thought about it. And this is part of what this is all about, is just getting back into the practice of looking for things. I mean, where I put that in, you may have seen the bit where I put, if you've had some bad weather, if there's been some rain or dark clouds, and then the sun breaks through right at the end of the day, if you put the sun on your back and look in the direction the sun is shining, you get one of those incredible landscapes where everything appears to glow almost like sort of neon. And again, we've seen those things, but it's just a case of understanding, you know, where to look and when to look. And it's really not rocket science.
We all love rainbows when we happen to stumble upon one. It didn't occur to me that they could be used to notice something about the weather.
Yes, rainbows are one of my favorites, because one of the things I'm keen to say is I have a very sort of deductive way of looking at the natural world. I'm always, you know, if I see an insect, I'm thinking, what's it trying to tell me? What puzzle can I solve with the help of this insect? But I'm also very keen to say to people, we don't lose the beauty. And the rainbow for me is a you know, near perfect example of where we get a beautiful phenomenon going on in the natural world. But then we can also, if we choose to, we can go one better than enjoying its beauty by letting it teach us some things. So a rainbow only forms when we've got three ingredients. There needs to be sunlight, there needs to be water in the form of rain, and there needs to be an observer. We need to be there. If we're not there, there's no rainbow. So once we understand the basic architecture of the rainbow, so a rainbow only forms when the sun is behind us and the rain is in front of us. Then we start to bring some nice straightforward pieces together. So if we know where the weather has come from in our part of the world, where I am, it's coming from the west. It is large parts of the temperate northern hemisphere. You know, there's a trend for the weather to come from the west. So that means if we see a rainbow in the morning, the sun is behind us, the bad weather's in front of us, and the bad weather's probably approaching. So a morning rainbow means the weather's probably about to get worse, and a late afternoon rainbow means the weather's about to get better much quicker. But then we can take it to another level, because every colour in a rainbow is telling us something about the rain out there. And in the book, I go through what each colour actually signifies. But for most people, if it's a new idea, the thing to hold on to is a nice simple thing, that the more red you see in a rainbow, the bigger the raindrops out there. And we all know that difference between that really light mist, and it can be quite nice if you're a bit hot, and that really heavy rain that's, you know, the sort of rain that creates floods and flash floods. Well, if it's that really heavy, the big raindrops, then you see a lot of red in the rainbow. And the way, that's a lot of information to take on if somebody's new to it, so I try and keep it simple. And the way I put it is, lots of red means a wet head.
You talk a lot in the book about prevailing winds, which seem to be something that's really important to those who are navigating through the water, but they can matter as well when we're on land.
Yeah, it's one of the golden rules of natural navigation is being familiar with what the wind has been doing. And if you can, staying familiar through the course of a single day, but in particular, understanding what the trends in your part of the world are. So whenever I travel to a new part of the world, one of the first things I do, sometimes even before an aircraft's touched down, I'm looking down. I may even research it before I go to see where the winds come from most often. And every single part of the Earth's surface, it doesn't matter if you're in the middle of a big city, near the North Pole, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in a desert, in a jungle, if you know where the wind has been coming from most often, the prevailing wind direction, then you can find signs all around you, not least in trees and on the ground.
If we can smell smoke on a cold morning, we're likely to be able to hear distant sounds better. What's going on there?
Yeah, I love this example because it's joining a couple of, again, quite straightforward things together to sort of show us that actually we can start to make predictions and deductions that we might have thought a bit weird before. So normally, as we all know, it gets colder as we get higher. That's why the snow at the top of the mountain, but not at the bottom. But occasionally we get a weather phenomenon called a temperature inversion when it's turned upside down. And there's warm air that sits on top of cold air. And this quite often happens when we've had clear skies and a lot of the heat is radiated out of the ground. And what happens then is this cold layer of air near the ground creates, it's like a sandwich layer. You've got the ground, then cold air, then warm air. And lots of things get trapped in that cold layer. So the reason we're smelling the smoke is because smoke from homes and businesses and industry get trapped in that layer, and you get that constant faint whiff of smoke. It's not like the smell you get when a fire's only, you know, a few hundred meters away. It's that kind of mixed in musty smell. And if we smell that, it means there's a high chance of a temperature inversion. And in this inversion, sounds get trapped. So we all get to know, you know, our patch of the world better than other patches. And you get used to the sounds you can hear. And I think a lot of people are used to the idea that if you hear something you can't normally, that quite often means a shift in the wind direction. And that nearly always means a change in the weather to come. This is similar but slightly different, because it happens when there aren't any strong winds. So you suddenly start hearing things that you can't normally. And that is tied with the smell of the smoke. And it actually changes the way we see things. So things like sunrises and sunsets appear different as well.
For beginners who are trying to notice the natural world in a more extensive way than they have before, is there one sense that you should start with?
Well, I mean, our sense of sight is phenomenal. It's so good, actually, it tends to bully the other senses. So I'm actually quite often saying, you know, you will use your sense of sight, but occasionally let the other ones get in on the action. And one of the tests I quite like to do on my courses, which really surprises people, especially if I've got somebody who thinks I'm just going to be hopeless at this. There's no way I can do it whatsoever. I say to them, within an hour, I'll have you pointing north with your eyes closed. And it's, and they think, no, that's impossible. And actually, it is so simple. Once again, you tune into the wind. So what I do is I just lead people throughout. I go, okay, we're going to use a few signs. Nice, simple thing. The sun is due south in the middle of the day, every day of the year. Okay, so that must be south. And then I say to them, where's the wind coming from today? And they might go, oh, okay, southwest. And then like half an hour later, I'll say, okay, everybody, close your eyes. Now spin around until you're completely disorientated. And I move around so they can't use my voice to cheat. I say, if you're not dizzy yet, spin the other way. And when you're completely disorientated, stop. Now point north. And they, and almost everybody can do it. They just think, ah, yeah. The only thing I can feel is the wind. Now, where was it? Oh, that's southwest. So if I face towards that, I'm facing southwest. I know that, okay, north is going to be sort of behind me and a little bit to the left. And everybody tends to point within 10 degrees. So it's really straightforward stuff.
How can we figure out where people or animals have traveled before us?
Well, there are... The best approach to all of these clues and signs is to take the view that nothing is random and everything that happens leaves a mark or a trace of some kind. So there's some tracking in the book. Every time we walk across anything, we leave a mark. And the same is true of animals. So we can do a bit of tracking. And that, I think, is quite well understood. I think a lot of people know that tracking is possible, even if not everybody chooses to do it. In the book, though, I introduce people to one or two ideas that are slightly less well known, which is that certain plants have evolved to become much more tolerant of trampling. So if we walk over plants, almost all plants hate it and will die. But there are some plants that have worked out a way to survive if people and animals walk over them. So what we find is in areas where plants are on the edge of survival, animals going over them quite often will kill them off, but there'll be one or two, specialist plants like clover. And if you're anywhere near a lawn, it's a really good chance to have a look at this. Because lawns will have people and animals going across them, but not randomly. There will be common routes across, the shortest route to get somebody's front door, for example. And there, the grass doesn't do quite as well as the clover. So if you look carefully, and a good idea when you're looking for any clues or signs on the ground is to get your head down really low, because looking at things near horizontal, you see all sorts of details that you can't from the vertical, and you will start to notice the plants are slightly different. And that's a map in nature. That's a map in the ground. No paper involved and no electronics.
Getting down close seems to be a big deal. Like, we might think we can't see anything, and then changing our perspective matters a lot. You point out that there are some paths that might be invisible, but if you look from another direction, the light hits in a different way and we can see things.
Yeah, and there's lovely ways of demonstrating this. If you, if you've got a lawn nearby, ideally one where the grass isn't too short, if you draw your foot across it, so you're like sort of combing it with your foot, then have a look in the direction that your foot has moved from, and then move around and have a look in the direction that it's gone towards. And you'll notice that the grass appears shiny when you're looking, in the direction your foot has moved, and it appears darker in the direction it's come towards. And we all know those kind of like perfectly sort of mowed lawns where you get the light stripes and the dark stripes. Well, that's just an example of the same effect.
Tristan Gooley is my guest. He's an expedition leader and author of the new book, The Lost Art of Reading Nature Signs. You can be part of our conversation if you call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about the lost art of reading nature's signs with author and expedition leader Tristan Gooley. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email the show at think@kera.org. Tristan, I like when I'm out in nature looking at trees just for aesthetic reasons. I hadn't realized how much they might tell me about wind conditions, light conditions, just any number of things.
Yeah, trees are, like all plants, they can't move. So they have to be able to react to the environment. So a lot of scientists, large parts of the world depend on trees, of course, economically and in some parts of the world for survival. And so a lot of time and effort has gone into understanding, you know, how our trees grow, but not quite so much time and effort has gone into sort of reading it back the other way. So if I just give you one example, in Sweden and Norway, forestry is a huge part of the economy. So they spend a lot of time working out which trees fall over when the winds get too strong and why. And they worked out that, as we might expect, we know the roots hold the tree in place in winds. But what they proved was that the roots grow bigger, stronger and longer on the side the wind normally comes from. So actually, we can use the roots as a compass. We just look at it the other way. So that's just one of the 19 ways that I've collected in the book that trees are reacting to their environment. So once we learn one thing about our environment, and the prevailing winds is a really big one, then the trees are trying to feed all of this back to us if we're just curious enough.
More branches tend to grow on the south side of a tree.
Yeah, again, it's one of the really important building blocks for natural navigation and a lot of outdoor clues is where the light is coming from, the sun being due south in the middle of the day, every day of the year. So we get most of our light energy from the south. So if you think about it, a tree can't turn around. So it's got to grow more where the energy comes from. Every time a tree or any other plant is growing, it's reacting. It's got all these quite simple but put together really clever reactions going on, which influence which way it grows and how much it grows. So to give you an example, as you mentioned, more tree on the southern side, but it's not just the amount. The branches on the south side will grow closer to horizontal because they're growing towards the light. And on the opposite side, on the north side, they grow closer to vertical because they're trying to grow to where the light is. On the north side, there's no direct light coming from the sun, so they grow up towards the sky. They're trying to get closer to the light. And this creates what I call the check effect. So if you look from the west side of a tree, it looks like somebody's drawn a tick across the branches. And this is where it becomes a fascinating art for me because we can all like get our heads quickly around the idea, okay, sun is due south, and in the book I sort of explain how you find the North Star and lots of other methods like that, and that's straightforward science, if you like. But this is where it becomes an art, because we take a little bit of science and then we have to practice seeing these things and learning how to read them, and that's where it becomes a really exciting subject for me.
Yeah, how many trees do you have to see even in a given area to make a conclusion about things like prevailing weather patterns or which direction they are planted in?
It depends a lot on the area you're in. If you're in an exposed area, then the winds will nearly always give you a pretty good compass in the first tree you see. And it doesn't have to, we're not talking about, you know, getting halfway up a mountain here. It's just, I mean, even trees right in the centre of London, I've seen right at the top. You look at, if you're not sure if you can see it, you just look right to the top of the tree, the part that's most likely to get the strong winds. And you sometimes, with practice, you just spot this, just a few twigs just sort of bent over. And if you notice it in one or two trees not far away and they're all pointing the same way, it's like a jigsaw puzzle at this point. You wouldn't want to take one tiny little clue and say, well, I've got a perfect picture of what's going on. You just put that in and then you say, okay, well, I've been tuned into the wind. Now I'm seeing what the trees are doing here. You know, an hour ago I saw the sun. I've lost it behind clouds now. But I'm now going to look at some other patterns and some other clues. And then suddenly all these pieces come together and you build, if not a perfect picture, then a really good one.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Chase in Arlington. Hi, Chase.
Hi. Great show, as always. So I have a question about something I've been told about. I've spent a lot of time outside camping and hiking, and I've always looked for this, but I've never been able to see it. Supposedly there's a green flash right as the sun sets on a flat sort of landscape. I don't know if it's mythology or if it really exists, but are there any tips to actually seeing that?
Great question, Chase. And yes, it's not mythology, but I know exactly why you're asking that, because lots of people like you have spent a lot of time outdoors get to hear about this. It tends to be the kind of people are having their sundowning drink and then the chat about the green flash starts. And it is true, it does happen. And the reason it happens is that the different colours in the light coming from the sun refract, bend by different amounts. And as the sun dips below, the blue light, it refracts so much it suddenly can't reach us at all. It gets scattered in the atmosphere. The red light can't bend quite enough. And what we're left with is just the bit in between, just for a tiny sort of microsecond. And in terms of tips of how to improve your chance of seeing it, if you heard earlier about the temperature inversion, what happens with a temperature inversion? I mentioned that it changes the way we see sunsets and sunrises. And normally, I think you'll all, if you're used to kind of open country, which lots of people in your part of the world are, then you'll have seen these sunsets where the sun gets really squashed. It's actually quite rare to see a perfect circle, because although we know the sun is a circle as it appears to us, it has to go through our atmosphere, and our atmosphere is always doing stuff to it. But the normal thing it's doing is squashing it, because the light from the top of the sun is going through a different temperature band than the light from the bottom of the sun. But keeping it, you know, on subject of the green flash, if we have a temperature inversion, instead of the sun being squashed, it gets stretched vertically. And the more it's stretched, the better the chance of seeing a temperature inversion. So if you suspect there's a temperature inversion, and if there is, there's a good chance there's good visibility and you can see reasonably far, unless you're a little bit unlucky and have some haze. But then you want to get that clear horizon to the west. It doesn't have to be a natural horizon, interestingly. You can see the green flash over a wall, you know, not right next to your eyes, but you can make your own clear horizon in the middle distance using a wall or something like that, and that will improve your chances slightly.
Have you seen it?
Me, yeah, I have, because I've spent quite a lot of time on the ocean, which is one of the great places to see it. But I'll be honest, there's a couple of times I've definitely seen it, and a few times where we were all debating if we saw it.
Because of that afternoon drink, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
I have some holly bushes in my yard that have gotten a lot of attention since I read your book. Of course, it's fenced in, and we don't have much action around them, but sure enough, they're not very prickly. Can you explain what we can learn from holly bushes?
Yes, it's a good example of how in nature everything's in competition. So anything that takes up energy or resources is something that a plant or an animal won't do unless it has to, ideally. So, I mean, a good sort of analogy is the hunting animal. Hunting animals don't sprint around, you know, randomly. They wait until they've got a good chance of catching something. And plants, you know, they're not hunting, but they are using energy, and it's a constant balance. So growing things like thorns and prickles and things like that as a defensive response makes sense. No plant wants to get eaten by a grazing animal or chopped off by gardeners, you know, more recently. But, you know, if there's no chance of that happening, they don't want to waste that energy. So what we find is, in a typical wild situation, a plant like holly will have lots and lots and lots of spines and you know, the prickly bits down near the ground, because that's where the grazing animals historically have been getting to them. And then if you look at the top from 2 to 3 meters up in a big tall bush, you suddenly find that nearly all of those spines have disappeared, because there's no point having spines 3 meters up in the air. There's no animal that can graze it there. And what we find is in gardens, you know, we've basically substituted ourselves, because the animals aren't grazing the holly. We're kind of pruning it, but it reacts in exactly the same way. It tends to be more prickly where it gets, you know, heavily pruned. But if you leave holly, you know, well alone and you keep the animals away from it, those spines tend to reduce and you get much smoother leaves.
If you're out camping or hiking or somewhere in Texas, you can see these beautiful fields that look really inviting to walk across. And sometimes you get halfway in and realize that they are just full of what we call stickers or nettles. Is there a good way to know if we are entering into a place where we're going to get all scratched up?
Well, in each part of the world, it's about tuning into the things the plants are most sensitive to. And one of the big things is all over the world is nutrients. So a lot of plants, well, let me put it a different way. All plants have succeeded by becoming specialists, even though that might not appear that way to us. So if we think that all plants are sensitive to light, the amount of water, temperatures, the amount of nutrients in the ground, some plants can survive with very, very low nutrient levels, things like pine trees. But other plants need lots and lots of nutrients. So things like stinging nettles and plants like that tend to be high nutrient loving plants. So there's a tendency, particularly if people haven't experienced the wild, there's a tendency to see a lot of these types of plants as growing everywhere. But actually what's happening is they're growing where we are because we make the ground rich in nutrients. So whether it's a farmer putting fertilizer on fields or you know, just anything human beings do, the way we live, we tend to get animals in one place, i.e. farming, and that concentrates all the nutrients into the soil. So there isn't a farm on earth where, you know, these nutrient loving plants like nettles aren't trying to thrive. So that you know, they can just be seen as weeds, but from a natural navigation perspective, the way to look at it is that actually they're part of a map. If you're going from a wild area and you're looking for a town or a city or anything like that, or civilization of any kind, quite often you will see these nutrient loving plants like nettles before any other ones. And it's not in the book, I really encourage people, don't think this is about memorizing, 50 different plant types. It's not like that at all. It's about noticing, the next time you walk from perhaps a slightly remote area to a built up area, just notice how things change along the route. You don't even need to be able to name the plants because you'll spot those patterns. Exactly the same thing. And the next time you go from a dry region to a wetter region, you just notice how the trees and the plants change. No need to name them at all. You know, some of the most skillful people in the world doing this use entirely different names to the ones than us. The names aren't the important things. It's the noticing and starting to build that map.
Even when I'm moving around through the city, I like watching what birds are up to. And you've explained that we can learn a lot about potential threats or things disturbing them by observing the ways that they take off from the trees or telephone poles or wherever they are.
Yeah, birds, as I think we all know, but sometimes forget, they are so much more sensitive to us. Again, because of this competition and all wild animals are in a constant battle for survival, which means if they get lazy in terms of their awareness, then they're a goner. So, we can afford to tune out. We can say, right, for 6 days, I'm going to focus on, normal modern living. But one day a week, I'm going to become really super tuned to my environment. The animals don't have that luxury. So they are constantly looking for threats to them. And what's going on out there is actually a rather beautiful, in the UK, we call it a neighborhood watch system. I don't know if it's the same over there. Do you have that
we
same
do.
System? Yeah. It basically, the animals have their own neighborhood watch system because they know they can't sense everything all of the time. So what's happened is they're tuned into each other and they're all being sensitive. So a good example is there will, in any area and pretty much any bird type, there will be one which is acting as the sentinel. It's the neighborhood watch, bird, if you like. It'll be high up on the top of a telegraph pole, on the top of a building, on the top of a tree, if you're wild, or on top of a rock. And it allows the other birds just to relax a tiny bit because they know if that high one spots something, it will fly. And in a lot of species, wood pigeons near where I live, but again, the names aren't important, the flight itself is a signal. So the bird doesn't have to, have a complicated conversation with all the other birds saying, guys, you want to be careful, there's something going on here. It just takes off and flies. And the flapping and the direction it flies is a signal to the other birds. So we're all kind of used to that thing in a city where, quite often you see people feeding birds and stuff like that, and then they suddenly fly off because they've been scared by something. It's just it's a more delicate, more sensitive way of looking at that. And then there are the alarm calls, which I can talk about if you like.
Yeah, please do, because it's remarkable the way that one animal will even alarm another animal of a different species.
Yeah, I got my best insight into the alarm calls when I did an expedition across the heart of Borneo. And I was with the Dyak, and they're so tuned to their environment. I mean, it's not that long ago. Nobody knows exactly how long, but possibly as recently as 50 years ago, certainly 100 years ago. In Borneo, there was headhunting going on. They were sneaking into each other's villages and hacking each other's heads off. And what they learned is it's pretty hard to sneak up on somebody if that person has tuned into the animal alarm calls. So in that case, it's the muntjac deer will not stay silent. If a human being moves through the rainforest, through the jungle, the muntjac let off a certain warning call. And so if people in the village hear that warning call, it's a call to arms, literally, to defend yourself. But we're not going to be, hopefully attacked by headhunters, but we can still have a lot of fun with this because these warning signs, these warning calls are going on all around us all the time outdoors, even in a city centre. So what happens is the birds can't afford again to have a really long, complicated conversation when something bad's happening. So they have a very simple type of call, and it's short, and it tends to sound a little bit sort of. I don't know how that's coming across, but it's in that kind of, because the young birds have to be able to understand it. Whereas what's thought of as the beautiful sort of bird sounds, the bird song, is complex. They're serenading, they're getting ready for reproduction, and that's not done by the youngest birds. So the lovely thing for us is the alarm calls are the simplest ones to identify. And again, you don't have to approach this from the complex thing of saying, oh, I must be able to identify this bird, and I must know its name, and I must know all its different calls. No. Next time you're walking out and you suddenly notice that the song has stopped and actually you're just getting these tick-tick-tick-tick-tick-tick sounds all around you, you've picked up your first alarm calls. And once you tune into that, it's one of the lovely things, just as the other animals pick up on it. So the deer pick up on the birds and squirrels and various other animals are all tuned into each other. We can actually dial in. It's like nature's radio station cross with this neighbourhood watch thing. So once you get used to doing it, you just notice it's been going on all your life. Every time you've walked, even in a city, but certainly when you get outside the city, it's going on all day, every day.
Are there things we can do, Tristan, to be a little more invisible to those birds that we don't intend to harm so that they don't fly away or warn each other of our oncoming presence?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, they are pretty canny. So the only two ways that they tend to work incredibly well are stillness. So in the book, I encourage people to think about taking a lunch break when they want to study this sort of thing. So instead of sort of thinking, well, I'm going to walk from here to here and I better keep going because I haven't got enough time, make the distance shorter and spend, if you can, half an hour in one spot enjoying a sandwich or something like that. Because after about 20 minutes, the birds will start to sort of go, this person is not quite such a threat. And the other thing is repetitive patterns. Birds are more intelligent than we give them credit for. So if we do the same thing every day and we don't attack them, they quickly work out that we're not going to attack them the next day.
My guest is expedition leader and author Tristan Gooley. His new book is called The Lost Art of Reading Nature Signs. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with expedition leader Tristan Gooley, author of The Lost Art of Reading Nature Signs. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Tristan, this book is not like a survival guide so much as an inspiration to just pay more attention. But talk a little bit about how we can find our way to a water source if we're not sure where there is one.
It's very closely related to some of the other clues we've been looking at, and it fits in with this general idea that every single plant and animal has its habitat. Now, that sounds a very vague thing to say. People tend to sort of think of it like sort of areas of a map. Oh, okay, so this bird, will be found west of this mountain range, but not east of it. But actually, if you want to pick up on the clues and signs, it's about getting into what its habitat actually is. So again, it's the in terms of animals, it's food sources and it's water. Every single animal, including human beings, struggles once you get a certain distance from water. If we look at those maps you see from satellites of the brightly lit parts of the world, and we see New York and a few other places sort of blaring out there, and London and Paris like blaring out there, and then it goes very dark in other places. Well, there's quite a strong relationship between where that light's coming from and water. You see an awful lot of dark in places like the Sahara, of course. But if we zoom in to a more personal level, exactly the same thing is going on. So there are lots and lots of trees that can survive with middle amounts of water, but there are certain trees that specialize in coping in desert regions, and there are other trees that specialize in something that's just as hard for plants, which is waterlogged areas. So in each part of the world, you'll find your water specialists and your dry specialists and a few in between. And really the trick is, again, without sort of thinking about memorizing certain types, is just the best thing to do actually is if you're on a walk in a reasonably sort of natural environment, you know, you don't have to be 100 miles from a city, but you know, it's the plants are growing naturally there, and you suddenly come across water. You know, it can be a stagnant sort of lake or pond or a river or anything like that. The best thing to do is actually backtrack, you know, backtrack 200 or 300 meters if you can, and then go and do exactly the same thing again, only this time watch how the plants change. And there'll be a really dramatic change at the water's edge, because that's where you get the out-and-out water specialists, willow trees and similar. But again, it's about noticing these trends, and they're very slightly different in every part of the world, but they exist in every part of the world as well.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Liz on the line in Dallas. Hello, Liz.
Hi. Love your show. Always so great.
Thank you.
I have a comment and then a question. We live in the city, and we have in our backyard for the last 4 or 5 years, we have a pair of screech owls, the little tiny, you know, like 7-inch owls that come and nest in our backyard, about 13 or 14 feet up into the tree. So they're actually quite close to the ground. And they, it's like they're part of the family. They know our dogs. They know our cats. They know all the neighborhood children. And they know when, you know, who's a threat and who's not. And it's just been wonderful to observe these little owls. And we installed a camera in their box in the summer after they left, and now we watch them on our TV monitor and share them with the neighborhood. But we've read everything we can about these little screech owls, and there's not a lot about them. So we're wondering if there's a research organization or someplace we can contact to share our observations about these screech owls and how well adapted they are to city life.
Interesting question. Thanks, Liz.
Yeah, thanks, Liz. Lovely observation and a very interesting question. And I don't have an instant answer for you, but I'd be surprised if there wasn't anything. I mean, I came across both a book and a community about the way bats are communicating, and you know, that's a far far less well understood area than owls. So I'd be very surprised if there isn't, and I mean, I'm assuming that you've had a bit of a search on the internet. I'll have a look as well after the show. I'll have a bit of a dig around and put a couple of emails out, and if I uncover anything, I'll send it to you via the show. But your observation is it sort of fits very nicely. Although I don't know screech owls, you know, that well, it's part of this pattern of familiarity, and it reminds me of the number of people who can tell from their own dog's bark, you know, whether it's somebody going past that the dog knows or it's somebody going past the dog doesn't know. You know, your owls will be doing that as well. Whether we can pick up on that level with an animal like an owl is you know, a fun one for you to study and share, hopefully. Thanks a lot.
Once again to the phones, this time we have Bob on the line in Dallas. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hello.
We live sort of in the woods in East Dallas, and we notice the crickets and the frogs make a tremendous racket most of the time, and then at some point in the fall, they seem to go quiet. Do they all go quiet at once? Is there any phenomena like that?
It's a fascinating question, and the cricket sort of family, broadly speaking, obviously lots and lots of species, but they are very, very sensitive to temperature. So to the point where 1 or 2 degree change will silence them, and we find that with lots and lots of animals, you know, reptiles as well. adders in my part of the world will only come out once the thermometer goes above a certain level. Below that, they just don't move at all, really. But the crickets are notorious. Actually, in the book, I haven't got the name of it in front of me, but it's not terribly important. There's one that's so sensitive that it's been used as a thermometer even. But they are all sensitive to that, so that's probably the reason why it suddenly goes quiet. Does that fit with your observation?
I was wondering if maybe it was the ground temperature that finally reached a certain level that maybe had the effect or something.
Yeah, that is almost certainly the case. They're just that finely tuned to their environment, specifically temperature.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned the usefulness of looking at a body of water and then sort of moving away from it to see how the plants around it would change and how the ground would change. And that seems to be a really good way to sort of draw some patterns. You also suggest that if we're trying to learn how to read tracks, how to understand tracks, like wait for a snowy day or look for some mud, like start with the easy stuff and then we can go from there.
Yes, because I think, and this was certainly true for me, it's a little while ago now, but I think all of us, when we find out there's a whole body of knowledge out there, but we're new to it, there's a great temptation to kind of throw our arms up and go, well, that's clearly for somebody else. There's a load of stuff and it's totally alien to me. So in the book, I really take the approach that, get the quick wins. So if it doesn't have to be snow, it can be sand, mud. You just notice. I've got an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old, a couple of boys, and I'm always sort of saying to them, we're not going to go out there for sort of 7 hours until everybody's exhausted and fed up tracking. I say to them, we're going to beat our record. Yesterday we found, 7 animals. Today we're going to try and find 8, but that all started with 1. You go out there and, when he was 3, he was going, it's a horse, So it's starting there and then incremental, rather than sort of thinking, wow, there's some people out there who are experts in this stuff and I'm not one of them, so it's not for me. You just build tiny little layers. I mean, that's all I did, tiny little layers. And that's how to make it fun, because once you've got one little layer, I mean, the stars is a great example. A lot of people think, wow, to be able to kind of like, tell the time or find your way using the stars. That's going to be difficult. Finding the North Star, very straightforward, easy diagrams in the book. And then you just add one more method. You say, okay, well, I've done that, half a dozen times. I'm just going to add one more. And that suddenly you recognize 3/4 of the night sky and you're telling the time using the stars. And it just creeps up on you in a nice way.
And we can use the North Star to determine our latitude.
Yes. Well, this is... it's shocking to some people how straightforward it is. But the way to think of it is the North Star is directly over the North Pole. If you were standing on the North Pole and you stared directly over your head, the North Star would be there. So that is 90 degrees above our horizon, and the North Pole is at a latitude of 90 degrees north. If we then hopped all the way down to the equator, if the conditions were right, you would see the North Star just sitting on your horizon. So at the equator, your latitude is 0 degrees, and the North Star is sitting 0 degrees above the horizon. As you move north from the equator, the North Star starts getting higher. Once you're 10 degrees north of the equator, the North Star is 10 degrees above the horizon. And in the book, I describe how you can use an outstretched arm and your fist on its side with the thumb on top. That's roughly 10 degrees for most people. So imagine jumping from the equator 10 degrees north. Suddenly the North Star is an outstretched arm and fist above the horizon. Jump another 20 degrees north and it's 3/5 above the horizon. Keep on going to the North Pole. You get the idea. But that's how an awful lot of navigators got going. It's one of the most straightforward and easiest ways to get into navigating long distances.
Since you've done all of this solo exploration and you also take people on these group expeditions, can you talk about how the experience is different if you're all by yourself, you have only yourself to rely on, but also only yourself to worry about, as compared with being with your sons or taking a group somewhere?
Oh, it is. It is a fascinating area, the psychology of it. And like almost all outdoor experiences, what I find is that if you get a positive, you also, get something taken away. So in a group, you get to share experiences. I mean, part of my work is observing and sensing things and then coming back and writing about them, which is a form of sharing. But if you you spot a particularly beautiful deer crossing your track or something like that, that's the moment when you're on your own where you just want somebody next to you. It's like, oh, I want to share that moment. But also, it's a real challenge. I mean, once a group gets to know each other, so if you're within the same family, it's not a problem at all. And I, you know, my sons are in rhythm with me now, and we're all kind of used to that in our own way with our own families and stuff. But if you're with a new group, it takes quite a long time to instill some quite simple ideas. And one of the ones that I talk about lots is you know, the zone of disturbance you make, you want that to be smaller than your zone of sensing. So you kind of, ideally, you only want to be sort of making a very small noise footprint, but actually sensing stuff that's perhaps, you know, a couple of hundred meters away. That way you're picking up tons, but it only takes the slightest sort of change. You know, let's say there are four people moving through the woods. If you all know each other and you all kind of know that, you just, as a group, you sense so much more. But if suddenly, you know, two people, you know, start chatting about what they're going to have for lunch, you know, the zones flip. You're telling things 200 meters away that you're there, and you're not sensing anything. So, yeah, you gain and you lose.
How do you estimate distance when you're out on a hike? Has it become something that you just have a sense for, or are there still tricks that you use to try to figure out how far you might be from a destination?
It's a mixture of tricks, experience, and a bit of an art. I remember when I was learning to fly a light aircraft, and any pilots listening will be familiar with this idea that, you know, if you've got a good instructor, they take you up and they say, you know, how far is that building from that bridge? And you, the first time you do it, you know, you're out by a factor of about 5 miles, and then and then you kind of get into it. And it's the same in all situations, but just to offer you a trick, one thing that's really good to do if you're in the same landscape repeatedly, which a lot of us are, is to actually know, let's say, the distance between any two things, and then we can gauge how far we are from that. So if you, it's rather hard to do without the diagrams and stuff, but so I'll just do a sort of brief version of it. But using something called parallax, which is the way things in the middle distance jump from left to right if you look at them from slightly different angles. And by that I mean if we open our left eye and close our right eye, and then vice versa. So something everybody can try now, even indoors, if you point at a wall, close your left eye and look at where your finger is on the wall, then close your right eye and open your left eye, and your finger will jump a tiny bit. Now, using that gauged against various things you know in the distance, you can actually work out how far you are from them. I'm sorry, I can't do a better demonstration on the radio, but hopefully you get the general idea.
No, that's good. We'll just hope people are not doing that while driving their cars listening to the show.
Yes, yeah. The passengers.
Last thing I want to ask you very briefly, surely you carry a notebook with you when you're out and observing. What kind of notebook do you use?
Well, I carry one of the you know, key things for me is actually a pencil, because I've lost so much stuff through rain, and I have a heap of notebooks, and it tends to be, you know, the nearest one. But I also actually I'm not anti technology, and I actually find a smartphone camera is an amazing way of just taking a quick note effectively. So you're not trying to win a photography prize, you just kind of go like, oh yeah, I've never noticed that there. But instead of having to write about it, you just take a quick photo, and you keep on moving, and then, you know, 3 days later you sort your photos, and it's like having a little note but with a bit of color in it.
Tristan Gooley has led expeditions on 5 continents, climbed mountains in 3, and flown and sailed solo across the Atlantic. His new book is The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs. Use outdoor clues to find your way, predict the weather, locate water, track animals, and other forgotten skills. Tristan, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thanks a lot. Really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Lauren Aguirre. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.